Welcome to the Smarter Trading Podcast. If you want to sharpen your trading skills or become a more savvy investor, then you're in the right place. Every week, we sit down with professional traders who are ready to share practical insights on what it takes to succeed in modern day markets. Smarter Trading, the show to watch to trade smarter.
Evan Medeiros is the founder and CEO of The Trade Risk. All opinions expressed by guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Evan or The Trade Risk. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as the basis for investment decisions. Evan and guests may maintain positions in securities discussed in this podcast.
This episode of Smarter Trading is sponsored by Investor's Business Daily. Some people say it's not possible to time the market, but William O'Neill and the experts at IBD created a system that helps you stay on the right side of the action, aggressive in uptrends and protected in downtrends. IBD digital members get daily updates on the current market conditions so they always know when to take action. Join IBD Digital today and be in the know. Podcast listeners can get their first 2 months for only $20 by going to investors.com/Evan. That's investors.com/EVAN. Now, let's hear about today's guest. Our guest today is Eddie Alfenbein. Eddie has been a leading writer in the financial community since starting the Crossing Wall Street website and CWS Buy List in 2005 and 2006, respectively. He often appears on CNBC and Bloomberg, where he shares his insights on the market and the economy. In this episode, we talk all about constructing a high-quality stocks portfolio. This has nothing to do with technical analysis. Eddie walks us through how to find value by looking for companies with pricing power, consistency in earnings, strong operating margins, and clear competitive advantages. Eddie breaks down the process he uses to craft the CWS buy list every year and shares his thoughts on a few of the companies currently on his buy list. If you're someone looking to sharpen your fundamental analysis, this one's for you. Please enjoy this episode with Eddie Alfenbein. So I would like to start by taking a look at a couple of the stocks, the companies that you own right now. So you have the Crossing Wall Street buy list, and we're going to talk about that buy list in just a moment and how you select these stocks. But I'd love to kick off with a name you own right now. It's a name I know nothing about, and it's ticker symbol MIDD, and I believe this is Middleby. So Tell me a little bit about the company and why you own it and what you like about it.
Interesting company. I think I have a knack for finding companies and liking companies that people don't know a lot about. They do something maybe a little unusual, but I particularly like companies. They're really the only ones in the field. They have either a near monopoly or a very strong niche. So Middleby is a company that does, of all things, industrial baking. This is something that people don't even think about. What industrial baking? But think about every restaurant, every hotel, every large organization. Middleby does business with 97 of the 100 largest food companies, be it chains or hotels. If you need that, you need a big baking machine, you need a big conveyor that brings all the biscuits around, you don't know where to go to, Middleby is your guy, and they will help you out. I particularly was attracted to them. I always say this, it sounds funny, but the stock got creamed. That's why I liked it. And that happened during the the panic last year when COVID initially hit. The stock market fell by about one third in just a few weeks, a few days, some of the worst losses. And Middleby trailed that awful market, and the stock went way down because people thought going out, restaurants, that's all going to be shut down, and they were. And the stock has come back very, very impressively. So that's been, and their earnings will come out. One of the downsides about this is, I'll say some companies are very good with corporate communications. Some companies aren't quite as good, and Middleby, probably just because they're not as well known, they're always the last company to say publicly when they're going to report. So they just said it's going to be next week. And they're always the last one. They're the stragglers to wait. So I'm looking forward to their earnings report, which will be next week.
Yeah, what a slingshot of a rubber band that this stock has experienced, right? Because, I mean, it's up, I mean, time of recording this, probably 40% year to date in early November. So it's been impressive. And you just spent, you know, a few minutes talking about this company. You clearly know a lot about it. This is contrary to a lot of the guests that we have on here that are just looking at technicals and they say, I have absolutely no idea what this company does. So this spills into your philosophy and the Crossing Wall Street buy list. So tell me a little bit about how this stock meets your criteria. How did it get on here in the first place?
I like to find companies that are niche players. They have a very strong, defined role in their marketplace. If you do that kind of business, you basically have to go through Middle B. And there's a few reasons why that's important. One is it gives a company pricing power. Doesn't mean they are raising prices, but it means they can if they have to. A lot of times when we look at the revenue, we don't want to just look at the bottom line, but we want to look at the volume that the business is doing and also the price increase. We're seeing that now with an uptick in inflation. I also like to look at companies that have a consistency in their earnings and their business performance. Doesn't have to be. I understand some companies are cyclical by nature, but I like to see that consistently, the steadily rising line, the steadily rising earnings and dividends, all of that I like to see. I like to see strong operating margins. So that tells us how efficiently, I mean, I don't always have a magnifying glass on management. But if I look at their operating margin, that's a good indication that the company is well run and management is controlling costs and on top of things. So I never look at one specific variable, but rather a collection of many different variables that tells me a company has a competitive advantage, it's well run, and hopefully going for a decent price. And if you can get over those hurdles, then you'll be a good candidate for our buy list.
Got it. And how long, what is your ideal hold time on a stock like this?
Well, on the buy list, we have 25 stocks and every year we replace five. So five get kicked out, five new ones come in. So that implies a holding period of 5 years. A lot of people, they see that as a huge negative. I'm placing an anchor on myself. I see it the opposite way, because when I'm going to add a new stock, I think to myself, is this a company I'm going to be comfortable with for at least 5 years? When you adopt that mentality, you really change how you think about an investment. I know many, many people listening to you are traders, and that's a very, very long period of time. But I like to look at the stock, say, like I have Disney. Is Disney going to be around in 5 years? Yeah, I think there's a very good shot they will. Middle B, I think another very good shot they will. And I say, well, if they have some short-term problem, something that needs to be addressed, will that be taken care of over the next 5 years? Middle B, the way their management works, I feel very certain about that. The average is 5 years. Some I've had, Pfizer has been on for the entire, and so has Aflac. They've been on for 15 years.
Yeah, great performers. And yeah, I'm really excited for this conversation because I hope to, you know, make this a little securities analysis kind of masterclass here on how to think about companies and this type of investing. So one of the things that I'm sure you pay some attention to at least is obviously the price that you're willing to pay for a particular stock and future earnings stream. So with something like a Middle B that is up 40% this year, does that suddenly now when you start to get to 2022 and you think about having to maybe shift this list, is it getting expensive? Is that how you think about potentially rotating out of names, or do you not really care? Performance is a good thing that it's heading up for you.
solely making a sale, I try to avoid selling solely based on valuation. Mm-hmm. And this is something I think a lot of people who aren't into value investing, as I see it properly understood, I think overlook. And that is, I don't just say, okay, this has a PE ratio of this and it gets to a PE ratio of that. What I think a lot of people overlook is the ability for the company to grow. So I'm not so concerned about their price of middle B versus their earnings for this year, but rather I see implicit within the business, is this a business that can continue to grow over the next 2 to 3 and 5 years and maybe more? So that's a roundabout way of saying largely no. Is that I don't say, okay, it's just too expensive and it's time to go. What happens more frequently when I decide to sell is the stock is what I would say, it's no longer the company that I originally bought. So what do I mean by that? It can be a few things. One is they've probably the most common is they've taken on an unwise acquisition. So I bought the company because they do this. And now I find out they do this, this, and this. The only one of those was the one I bought. Also, a lot of times companies that we buy are bought out themselves. So that happens. Mm. And then probably the most disappointing is there's some change in the business. They don't have that market niche anymore. They don't have the leadership. Maybe the management has made some problems. They've taken on too much debt. What attracted to me originally, my original thesis is no longer operative. And so that leads me to buy it. So, but to circling back strictly on valuation, no, I'm much more willing to let the company run. There's a great quote by Peter Lynch, and he says, more money has been lost in preparing for corrections than in corrections themselves. And I find that to be true in the sense that the stock can go almost always can go higher than you think. And Jesse Livermore said, it's not my thinking that made me money. It was my sitting. And yes. I find that to be very true.
I really like that point of thinking about sort of what you signed up for, right? If a company, you know, if you signed up because the company was dominating in a specific niche, but then they, you know, start dabbling in all these other industries or other business models, then that's more the red flag to you rather than letting a company grow into their earnings. That's very thoughtful. And, you know, I'm already appreciating that myself as I start to think of things that I try and hold, but I am very sensitive to prices by themselves and I don't have that longer term vision. So that is extremely helpful. So, you know, the buy list that we're talking about here, has been around. How long has it been around? Because it's been around for a very long time.
A long time. This has been our 15th year, so we're about to have our 16th. So I guess that was a long time.
Yeah, this has been as long as I've been, you know, trading, basically, I've seen this popping in. So this is your classic core buy list. And then you now, in the recent 3 years, is it, or 2 years, you've got the ETF, you've got the CWS ticker symbol, advisor shares focused ETF, which is your buy list in an ETF, or it tracks the buy list, right?
So we celebrate actually 5 years. So 5 years.
Wow.
And not many ETFs have made it that 5 years. And you're right. What so many people said, I love the buy list. Is there a way I can invest in it? And I think if you add up all the stocks, one share, it comes to something like $4,000. So I partnered up with Advisor Shares. They've been a terrific partner and we made an ETF. And as you were alluded to, we have to say it's based on the buy list. We can't say it is the buy list. If you run an ETF, I've learned that you have to hold even just a tiny bit of cash, you know, 0.6% just to operate the fund. So
sure.
It's not 100%, but I've found it mimics the buy list to a very high degree.
You know, you laid out some of that criteria you look for of a leadership in the industry and strong operating margins, earnings consistency. So when I think about these things, how do you like to benchmark yourself against, right? Now, ultimately, you're going to get benchmarked against the S&P 500, but that's a very different fund than kind of what you're constructing here. Like, what type of benchmark do you find yourself closely resembling?
It would be most closely to high quality portfolios. I've noticed that people have very different definitions of high quality, but for the most part, it seems there's a broad similarity of high quality ETF products out there. And the S&P 500 does have a high quality subunit of the S&P 500. I don't know exactly how those are calculated. I think everybody has their own secret formula, but you have a good sense that it's going to be like a Johnson & Johnson is going to be, sure, you know, companies like that. So I think I most closely conform to that. But let me make it clear, I don't think of myself as this is a high quality product. I think it just probably in the end is most similar to those ETF products you see out there.
So what is your background? Let's talk about that a little bit. Are you, you know, were you learning about securities analysis at a young age, or is this something you, you know, developed into and kind of picked up later in life?
I do remember, you know, I used to read, showing my age, when I would read the sports page as a boy, and always in the back they had the stock table. So I was always fascinated with that. And I bought a few stocks, not much, when I was a teenager. And so it was always fun watching that. And then you get a dividend check. But I was always sort of fascinated by the stock market. And I decided to get my MBA. And once I got that, that was sort of a fast track. There was a group of students that were really interested in the market and studying the market. And so after I got my MBA, bounced around, had a couple jobs in finance. Then when I was still pretty young, I started my own newsletter when I was in my 20s. And this was read by dozens and dozens of people, but I had fun doing it. And it was a great learning experience. And I had some readers follow me, and then, but it never got to be very big. So after that, I went to work for a newsletter publisher. Some of your listeners may be aware of Phillips Publishing, which used to be a major newsletter publisher. I really enjoyed working for them, and they have a lot of big newsletters. And you know, learned a lot there, and got to do that. And then I did that till about 2005. And then I decided to become a consultant, and I was doing that. And then the newsletter, the ETF launched in September of 2016, and then I launched my Substack in April of this year.
Can't believe it's been 5 years on the ETF launch.
Me too. And we're very crazy. Close to doubling. We IPO'd at 25. And we're getting very close to, I think we're north of $49.50 on the net asset value. So we're closing in on 50, an official double in 5 years.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a big congrats to you. That's 5 years is tough. You've made it through the graveyard of early ETF launches.
Many. Yeah, it's littered with bodies. Let me also, I want to say something to a lot of your listeners who, you know, I'm sure many are traders, many follow technicals and things like this. And what I say is maybe very different from their experience. In no way do I see as one way is superior than another. I have a great admiration for technical analysis. I would not call myself one or certainly an expert, but I don't see it as sort of one against the other. It's sort of what you may be temperamentally better suited to one area. Your goals may be better suited. So it's an important point I wanted to get across, that there are many different ways of going about of being a successful investor. I don't believe there is in any way I would advocate one over another.
So I want to dig a little bit more into your process of kind of constructing the ETF. And then I also want to a little bit later think about maybe the do-it-yourself trader at home that's trying to, you know, kind of do something similar to what you're constructing here. But when we think about your process for constructing the ETF, there's, 6,000 stocks out there somewhere, give or take, and you have to get it down to 25. So right. Like, what is, what is some of the top funnels or, criteria that you're using to eliminate the bulk of those stocks? What's the right. first step?
Well, what I do is I have sort of two steps. I have what I call my watch list. And that's a name of about 100 stocks. And those are stocks that I wouldn't say I'm an expert on, but I know something about. I know the elevator pitch about the stock. And you just can only follow so many. So, and I find that list, I add to it and it grows too large and I need to pare it back. So having about 100 names, 80 to 100 names, and I'll notice, oh my God, it's at 150. I got to pare this back. So those are companies that I say, these are good companies. They're in the field of companies I kind of trust, I know something about. And I think of that as the minor leagues for the buy list. That's AAA stocks that have gotten there. And includes former buy list stocks as well. And there are, companies I look at all the time. I think, man, it's just not right at this time. So it's getting to my watch list is the big one. I would say the key things I look for are consistency of earnings growth and a well-defined market position. I think I'm reiterating some points I made, mm-hmm. but those are the big things. If I see something that's just that I don't know anything about the industry, I just can't make a sound judgment on that. So a lot of, particularly in the biotech sphere, I know there are many good, I just don't know that. I cannot claim any expertise on that. I know that many of those stocks probably should not be publicly traded and they're at the research stage and they're not at the product stage. And I understand that's the game, how it's done. But I just don't, I can't say, oh, I know this and this is going to be big. That's not something I know. A lot of times, a lot of embryonic industries, things that are just starting out, I think a good example would be 100 years ago, the American car automobile industry, there were 400 car companies. And then we know as the big three, it became consolidated very quickly. I like a lot of legacy companies that have pretty simple and straightforward to their operations, nothing super complicated, not a lot of international divisions and currency and off-balance sheet items. That kind of scares me away. Again, I'm not saying that they're bad. They're just not good for what I'm looking for. I like to have companies that I trust. Good example, I have like Hershey is mm-hmm. on the buy list. And there's no town in America called Gluten-Free America, but there's a town called Hershey. People love their chocolate. And I know Hershey is going to be around. They've been around for a long time. And I know that they will, as long as people are eating chocolate, they're going to be around. So a lot of the super, super fancy, complicated things I just don't understand about, that's going to go off. Inconsistency of their operatings, it shoots up, shoots down. I'm going to steer away from that. I will do one exception is there are just cyclical industries. Think like home builders. Home builders, it's just a feast or famine. That's the nature of the industry. So I'll adjust for something like that where I understand that's how the business is. And so if companies are able to pass those filters, then it goes on the watch list. Again, about 100 names. And then as we get time to make the changes at the end of the year, I'm doing that right now, I'll look at the names on the watch list and who, right after earnings season, somebody gets knocked down for a transient issue. Mm. And, you want to see, okay, this is a problem, but are they able to fix this? Yeah, right. I think so. Aflac, I remember a year or two ago, a company came out with an expose about all these awful things that Aflac had done. And the headline, Aflac went down when that came out. I looked at the article, And I thought it was some pretty weak sauce. And I think here we are a few years later, it didn't do any real damage to Aflac. Yeah. So that's a good reason. If a watchlist company just gets knocked down and it's a good value, then it becomes a good candidate for the buy list.
Yeah, thanks for that detail there. And so I'm curious though, even like, do you have another room in the house that's just a library of papers and everything from like tracking all of these companies? Is it Google Docs where you keep like a document on each company? Like, how do you track? Because you're doing more than just, you know, I mean, you gotta put all that information somewhere. Like you say, these are the minor leagues. Maybe the information or the company that you have, the information, maybe it's not ready yet, but next year, you know, it might be. So what's the process for kind of tracking this on your end?
I have a group of people called Oompa Loompas, and they do all the work. They're small people.
I knew there was something.
They do all the work for me. I wish I don't have a good answer. I love doing it. This is something I enjoy. I like reading, you know, 10 Qs and 10 Ks. And there are so many companies I know absolutely nothing about. If somebody asks me what my opinion on Tesla or something, I just don't know. A lot of the big banks, I just don't know. But the oddball companies, those are ones I know. And I keep some spreadsheets with data on that. Just, you know, some basics just so I get a handle of where they are and what they're doing. But really the secret to them is there's a lot of great companies that are hidden in plain sight. You just wouldn't know it. I tell people, look at a long-term track record of Colgate-Palmolive. It's a CL. It's a gigantic winner over the decades. And people say I hear all these arguments for it's demographics or it's this or it's that. They make toothpaste. That's all they do. And it's been a huge winner for so long. There's really no secret I have. I just follow lots of companies and I keep notes on them.
Got it. So you've mentioned it now, I think twice, about companies that are, I mean, maybe let's just call them smaller in size or even just have, they don't have an army of analysts covering them like an Apple or Google or, you know, where there's a million people dissecting every corner of that company. Do you find there to be more edge/value in these lesser followed companies, the smaller cap companies?
Absolutely, because fewer eyes are following it. Some of the most popular things I've ever written about on my blog are what I call orphan stocks. And these are stocks that aren't followed by any analyst on Wall Street, or sometimes maybe one or two, and you don't know the last time they've looked at the company. It's always interesting. Did they beat earnings expectations? I don't know, because there are no earnings expectations. I'll give you a good example of that. And this is a company that's well known on Wall Street, but the business, not the stock, and that is Nathan's. Nathan's Famous, the hot dog stand. Now, if you were to go back 20 years ago, this has been a gigantic winner over the last 20 years. Ticker symbol is NATH. It's creamed just about every hedge fund, just about every mutual fund, every ETF. It's destroyed a lot of well-known stocks, and the number of analysts is absolutely zero. Nobody follows it, and I bet half the analysts on Wall Street go there at lunch. people don't even think that Nathan's Famous is publicly traded. So I did a post on Wall Street orphans, and it's interesting because it's the area of Wall Street that no one writes about. As a result, no one writes about it because no one seems to be interested in it. It's often even the opposite, because you get analyst coverage a lot of times because companies go to the bond market and they get a big underwriting and they've used that investment bank, and then the investment bank will give them a rating. So really, a lot of times it's not only is it not a negative, it's an absolute plus to not be followed because they haven't done some unwise financial product. Nobody's, you know, they're funding themselves. So it's I find an interesting dynamic. Another thing, if I could say, you talk about individual investors, there's people at home. Some of these orphan stocks, I'm able to call them up, talk to the CFO. You can do that. It doesn't take many calls or email them. And you can get the information right from the company. And sometimes you get out a little more information. A lot of companies, you just read their 10Q, their 10K, they sort of lay it out pretty straightforward. I like the companies that are frank about what went wrong and what went right in the quarter. So with just a little bit of research, there are a lot of smart folks out there, and you, within an afternoon, you could be one of the people as well-versed as anybody on the stock.
Yeah, such good advice. It's yeah, oftentimes, you know, we're staring at tickers all day and there's like a real company behind here and you can actually call them up and they might actually, you know, take that call and you can talk to them. So I love that.
I always think of like when somebody asks you, can you tell me about your job and what you do each day? Not many people are asked that. So yeah, when you ask people, they're happy to tell you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, very, very true. And we will be right back. Those of you who know Trade Risk know we are all about rules-based investing, and that's why we are so excited to have Investor's Business Daily as a podcast sponsor. William O'Neill and the experts at IBD created a proprietary market timing system that keeps you on the right side of the action, aggressive in uptrends and protected in downtrends. IBD digital members get daily updates on the current market trend, so they always know if it's a good time to be invested. Members also get access to IBD's top trade ideas, in-depth analysis, educational webinars, and much more. This is the framework for responsible investing, knowing when to be involved in the market and what stocks to have on your watch list. And with IBD Digital, you'll get both the information and education. Podcast listeners can get their first 2 months for only $20 by going to investors.com/Evan. That's investors.com/Evan. E-V-A-N. Now, let's get back to today's show. So for the people that are, you know, at home, maybe thinking about creating a watch list similar to what you've just gone through, you can get pretty far by doing some simple screening, perhaps, on PE ratios and operating margins. How far does that take you? Because you ultimately, though, you need to bridge that gap. You need to understand where that company's going in some sense. Is that right? It can't just be all numbers, or how do you see that?
No, you're correct. There's a tendency of Wall Street people, or I think it's the left brain, who are too numerical intensive. And you have to realize that the numbers are the end result of the story, and find out what the story is. What do they do that nobody else does? Why are customers happy to go back to them? What is it about them that makes them unique? So that story comes through the numbers, but it's not the numbers themselves. One of the great places to start is look at Dividend Aristocrats. There are ETFs that track this. It's not hard to find the list. Just Google it and find companies that have raised their dividends for 25 years in a row. It doesn't necessarily mean that's a great investment, but that's a good place to start. Then within that, I would look at things like how much debt do they have, what are their operating margins, and then lastly, I would see what kind of valuation. So that the Dividend Aristocrats, that's a really good place to start.
You did sort of allude to it here, and you mentioned the story and how that's important, because the numbers, you know, they just tell you the results. And the thing that the numbers can, I guess they leave out, I don't know, I guess this is debatable, maybe they include it, but there are intangibles, right? That when we think about companies, for instance, just, I mean, a network effect of a company or patents or some proprietary technology, like, those things don't necessarily show up in a PE ratio. So how do we think about valuing those? Do you try and assign value to those? Like, how do they fit into your valuation models?
I'll give you a good description. I hope this helps your listeners. And I'm borrowing this from the Investopedia people, but Imagine if you have a lemonade stand. So kind of suspend your imagination for a bit. So you have this lemonade stand and business is going well, and you get this idea about what you can do for your business. And each morning you go out and you buy lemonades, lemons for your business. Then you say, okay, what if we, instead of doing that every morning, we just do that once a week. We buy all the lemons just for that week and we get a bulk discount. So we get a little savings. Now think about that. That is kind of the ultimate in business. That is everything that business is geared for is shaving that little bit off, because that means you can lower your price, thereby gaining market share, and it's at no expense to your margins whatsoever. That right there, as bizarre as it may sound, that's the holy grail of business, because you are getting a big advantage over that. Now, that's the first scenario I described to you, and it's good, and you know, businesses go for that. Now I'm going to describe the second scenario, which is a little bit different. You invent a new kind of lemon squeezer, and you get out, let's say, 10% more juice than you did before. And let's say, you know, in the first scenario, you get a 10% savings on the lemons. So the numbers work out exactly the same. Again, you can lower your price, pass it on to your customers, gain market share at zero cost to your margins. But there's a big difference between those two scenarios, buying in bulk and the lemon squeezer. Buying in bulk is an idea, but you exist in the same economic universe as your competitors. So at some point, they can figure that out too, and your advantage goes away. But the lemon squeezer is different. And it's different because you can patent that. And you can marshal state power to enforce your monopoly on that. In reality, you would probably license the technology so you can get a revenue stream on that. Now, this implausible scenario I described between scenario one and scenario two lies a huge amount of wisdom. You want to look for that, in this case, intellectual property, which gives them an unbridgeable advantage over their competition. The first one, they could figure it out. The second one, they can't. They are locked out. And that is a huge boost to any business. So if those company, if those lemonade stands are both valued at 15 times forward earnings, but we know they're not the same. They're very different.
Yeah, great example. And it's just reinforces the doing the legwork to know more about the company, right? To actually understand, hey, there's something else here. These numbers might be the same on the, you know, on when you're screening, for instance, but there's something very different underneath the hood on how they're getting to those numbers. So
exactly.
Yeah, that is a great example. So now, so, you know, since we have been talking about, you know, valuation and how to think about, you know, companies and what to pay for them, you have a, I got to imagine this is a highly trafficked piece on your blog post. It is a beautiful, I love your blog just generally. So I'm going to throw that out there. Like, you know, everyone should go check out, I believe it's just crossingwallstreet.com. Right. And you can check out the best of section that Eddie has on there. And you've got complex topics that are just, there's no bloat. And I appreciate that. It is very succinct and you tell a nice tight story or in each of these pieces. But you have one piece on there called The World's Simplest Stock Valuation Measure. And why don't you just tell us about it and maybe how you came up with it?
Right. I was doing some very, very complicated modeling and it was getting too complicated. So I made a shortcut for myself. So I said, I want to make this model give me a result that will get close to what this model is doing. I wanted to get with 10% of the work, could I get 99% of the accuracy? And so it's sort of out of my laziness, I came up with this shortcut to get, and I am very clear in the post saying, this is just a ballpark. This is not a fair value. It's just saying, if you only know a couple facts about a particular company, this can get you a good sense of the valuation. And you take the growth rate, divide it by two, add it to eight, and that should be about the PE ratio for the company. That tends to be, for most instances, that will give you a share price much lower than where the market price is. So it's a good, you know, if you just are looking over data and you just want a good sense of where this is trading. Now, there a company may be going for a large amount higher than that, but there may be reasons. So that's telling me, where is just a ballpark, not knowing much. And it's a good sense and it's easy to do. It doesn't take long. It's nothing super complicated. And I found that people really enjoy that.
Yeah. Well, I certainly do. Growth rate divided by two, add it to eight. And that growth rate, I know, again, this is just a simple back of the envelope model, but that growth rate year over year, is that the number we would look at?
It's usually the analyst 5-year expected growth rate. And I'll usually do for the PE ratio, I'll do the forward PE ratio. Now, the real trick about that is that's just what the analyst community is saying. I like to find companies where I think the growth ability is being underestimated by the analyst community. That's the hard part. But that's a good area where you can think that Wall Street just has the story wrong. And just to circle back, when we talk about the analyst coverage, I think Facebook at one point had 50 analysts covering it, and something like 49 of them were buys. Right. So when the 51st person comes in, I don't know what they're adding to it, but I don't think it's very much. Where a company like Miller Industries, which I have as a cool small stock, it's not much is known about that. And so you instantly can become an expert on it.
So is that, thinking about the analysts out there, and I know we talked about, there being value in finding stocks that frankly don't have any analysts covering them. But I imagine then there are analysts that you might know by name that you actually appreciate their research, their models on, right? Is that something that you ever look at? Do you have a group of analysts that you like, or you just do it all yourself and pay no attention?
More to the latter.
Okay.
Yeah, I really do try to keep to it because I don't want to be biased by anything else.
I've followed your newsletter for a while, and you do write a lot about, or there's always at least some color on the macro environment. And I know based on your reading, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you're a bottoms up sort of company first, and then kind of worry about everything else. What role, does the macro environment play a role perhaps when it comes to this time of the year when you're selecting new companies? Are you trying, are you thinking about, inflation's ticking up, some industries might be doing better, interest rates are, such and such path. Is that a role that it plays or not so much?
For me, not so much. Again, I understand that there are some people who can do that and they have knowledge of the global market and the energy markets and what the Fed will do. I just don't claim expertise. Again, going back to that 5-year estimate, it forces me to think outside a lot of those macro variables. An example is I don't have any energy stocks on the buy list. So people ask me, so is this your call about energy? No, I just don't see none that struck my fancy for this year. I'm not that complicated. I look at the company, and if the company works for it, the Middleby will be selling its products in all sorts of economic environments. I do read a lot about the macro, and I write about it, but I wouldn't say that particularly changes my any of my investment decisions.
So if I'm thinking about maybe the listener here that is, again, kind of creating their own portfolio basket of names that they're looking at, maybe they don't have a 1 year minimum hold like you do. I know you want it to, you know, on average it's 5 years for each stock by definition, but I mean, let's say they're free to make those decisions kind of anytime. And what I'm getting to here is thinking about the sell discipline, and you alluded to it earlier. I like the phrasing that you use. It's price is not so much your leading factor. It's more if a company changes their, you know, the reason why you sort of initially bought it. Any other color maybe or wisdom you could offer mm-hmm. to retail traders on the selling discipline?
Sure. I think selling is one of those things. It's best when it's very disciplined. So mm-hmm. for people who are more short term, you really want to have certain points. If it gets to 82, I'm going to sell half. If it gets to 87, then I'm out completely. Those mm-hmm. sorts of things, even if they just seem like they're helter skelter, it really helps a lot just having a plan, mm-hmm. having, you know, some tight stops to protect you from the downside. Really going about it in a business way, I think is the best way, because you're applying some sort of discipline over what you're doing, which can be very chaotic. So mayhem can be going on, but you still have your plan. So I'm a big fan of those situations. Think beforehand, what's your exit point? What's your timeline for this? You know, the best selling strategy is what you buy at and when you buy, you know, that is part of the selling strategy. So think about that, what you're doing, if you're short term, how you're going to go about this, what, you know, if this happens, then you're going to do what?
Yeah, I really like that. So to, you know, kind of play out this scenario again for maybe the person that is constructing their own portfolio, on the macro side, is there a point at which, and I know you don't personally do this necessarily, not that I know of, but, you know, if the S&P 500, I don't know, let's say by the end of next year, it's at 6,500 or some, you know, but, you know, all time high historic, you know, cyclically adjusted, you know, earnings ratio. Do you, you know, does that person start to say, well, maybe I should be parking into the bond market or holding more cash or, you know, holding some gold or, you know, is there any, advice or wisdom on that side of stocks being too expensive as an asset class?
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, there are so many stocks, and also there are cycles within the market. So that if the market were at 6,500, I would be very curious to know who's leading and who's lagging. So even with under the hood of a febrile market, there are interesting things going on. When the market peaked in 2000, small cap value was not in that story. And that sector soared through all the 2000 aughts, whatever we call that decade. So even if the market is going, I would be looking for who's leading, who's lagging, why. What are the factors driving a great increase in valuation? So there's always a way to play this that doesn't include selling out of everything and shifting to gold and Bitcoin.
This is a question I meant to ask earlier, but when you're constructing a portfolio or thinking about a new name to add, are you paying any attention to the technicals? Are you worried, for instance, you know, if a stock's in a longer term or intermediate term downtrend, and you're, you know, are you thinking to yourself, what, you know, am I missing something here? Like, is that play into factor at all?
Mm-hmm. I don't. I'm not a technical person. My friend JC Peretz, he's great technical analyst. I respect a lot of technicians. I just don't know my chops there, so I don't know much about that. I do find it interesting, by the way, as a side note, how valuable the 50-day moving average can be. It's such a simple rule, but it really does tell you about the market's momentum. And historically, the S&P 500 has been markedly different when it's above the 50-day moving average versus below it. And I believe if you look at all the most volatile days in market history, a large majority of them have happened when the S&P 500 is below its 50-day moving average, and they really don't happen when they above it. I just find that fascinating. So it does tell me that I think there's a lot of value to technical analysis and stocks, you know, price is truth is the old saying, and that's absolutely true. I always find it interesting when someone will come out with a model and they say, my model says that the market is three times overvalued. Yeah. And my thought is, well, you're admitting your model has an error of 70-odd% or whatever. So
I love it.
Sometimes the market has a mind of its own. And that's why I like technical analysis, because it skips trying to find out all of the complicated reasons behind, but it says this, it's dealing with reality on its own terms. And that's what I admire about the technicals.
Well said. So we're going to start to wind down here slowly, but I'd love to hear maybe two more names in your current buy list right now. Maybe Heiko, or if you want to take a different one, that's fine. But ticker symbol HEI. I'd love to hear maybe just a little bit of color on that stock, if you don't mind.
Cool company, Heiko. They make interesting industry. They make replacement parts for aircrafts. Now, that's it's a lot of money to keep if you own an airplane and you want to keep it going all the time and something breaks down, there's not many places you can go to, but you can go to Heiko. And also a lot of these parts have very strict regulations surrounding them. And Heiko knows how to do that. So you can't just go over to, you know, your local Pep Boys, but you can go to Heiko and they know exactly what you need to get your planes back up in the air. Just imagine, think of it, if you ran an airline and you have a plane that's out of commission, who are you going to go to? Who do you know you can trust? Heiko is a great little business. Another company is Miller Industries. I was on my last podcast and I totally mangled it, but they're a towing and recovery company. They're by far the smallest company on the buy list. Another niche industry. There's not many companies that you are going to deal with, but Miller Industries is one of them. They're going to report earnings this week. We're speaking on in early November. Cool company. Another company that's not followed by any analysts on Wall Street. I also like you reading their earnings reports, their 10Q, their 10K. It's straightforward business. It's not all these super complicated off-balance sheet items. You don't need to be a business expert to understand their operations. So neat company, and the stock really got clobbered. I'd be interested to hear what a technician has to say, but it's off its low. And I think at some point it was going for maybe 9 times 2019's earnings. Everything since the pandemic started, all those, you know, that year, just throw it out. Business was so bad for them. But I have a lot of faith in them, and I think it's a very well-run company.
Awesome. Yeah, I love. Yeah, it's refreshing to just hear, you know, just to hear about what the heck is actually going on with some of these companies. So I love this philosophy. I like the work that you're doing. For people that want to learn more about this type of investing and you know, just understanding, you know, companies more and building a thoughtful longer term portfolio, your blog, absolutely a no-brainer. Any other book recommendations that are, you know, you'd have out there, or other blogs or resources?
Well, let me also point out that my ETF has its site, so it's at Advisor Shares. If you do CWS ETF, it'll come up. Lots of good information there. You can always see the holdings in that, 24/7. You always know what we have in that. Also, I'll just tell you a little fun thing. So the CWS is based on Crossing Wall Street. So I had the experience of being able to pick out a ticker symbol. And I don't think many people have had that opportunity to do that. So I had to go through all the ticker symbols, and I found out that CWS was available. So Beautiful. We jumped on that. And let me just say, if the Chicago White Sox, if they want to purchase that from me, I'm all ears. If they want to they want to make an offer, you know, let's see what they put on the table, or the College World Series. So I was able to do that. And it's traded on the what used to be the archipelago, it's now the NYSE ARCA. So, and we have our prospectus and everything like that. One good book, and I mean, it's basic and straightforward, but Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street, great intro to, if you don't know a lot about stocks and the market and investing, a very easy to read. He was a longtime manager of Fidelity Magellan, made huge amounts of money under his tenure, and talks about, you know, companies, find out what they do. His mantra is always buy what you know. The company that you use, that you know, is better than other people, because a lot of times the consumers have a better understanding of the market than highly paid Wall Street analysts.
So last question here. Anything that you believe, any beliefs you have, you've kind of got a few of them already sprinkled throughout this podcast as far as I'm concerned, but beliefs you have that maybe go against conventional investing wisdom, anything you hold close to your chest there that you just shake your head no when you hear people talking about it?
That's a good question. And I do have some, and I lean against, for example, I think diversification of your portfolio is largely overrated. I don't think you need to do that. It depends what stock you have. You can closely follow the S&P 500 with 8 stocks, and then you can not follow it by huge amounts with 200 stocks. There is lots of talk. I don't know how big this is nowadays, but they used to talk about the small cap effect, that over the long term, small caps are better performers. I know there's a lot of data. Frankly, I'm pretty skeptical. Even if it does exist, I don't think it's very, very big. I think people, as a general rule of thumb, tend to pay way too much attention to the Federal Reserve and what they do. And I would add politics. I talked about this investing from 30,000 feet. People talk about demographics being involved in reasons to buy a company. I just don't think that's terribly important. I think I hit on some of the major ones I have. Wall Street has a lot of odd beliefs that it's stuck to. I don't always know why it is that way.
Just firing all the controversial topics right before we're about to sign off now.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. So we've got the CWS ETF. That's where people can check out your fund and pick that up. You've got crossingwallstreet.com. Anywhere else we should hand people off?
And I have a Substack. It's CWS Substack. I'm sure that would come up on any Google search.
Got it.
And also with my ETF, we were the first ever ETF to have a fulcrum fee. So that means that the fee is variable depending on how well we perform. If we beat the market, I get a little bonus. If we fall short of the market, you as the investor gets a little savings. There were open-end mutual funds to do that, but we were the very first in the ETF space to do that.
That's incredible. 5 years ago and no one had done that. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, good on you, because obviously you're you know, choosing to give back some of your hard-earned incentive. But yeah, that's pretty wild. So awesome. That's it, folks. All the notes and links from this episode can be found on our website at thetraderisk.com/podcast. Thanks for tuning in. We hope to see you in the next episode. Eddie, learned a lot. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Smarter Trading. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. For all of the show notes, links, and callouts, head on over to thetraderisk.com/podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Smarter Trading is hosted by me, Evan Medeiros, and produced by Ashton Alexander. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope to see you in the next episode.